The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, November 3rd, the Good Girls Revolt edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I am joined by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And subbing in for Noreen this morning, I actually don't know where Noreen is, but subbing in for Noreen is Christina Cotarucci, a Slate staff writer. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Hannah.
So our three topics today, the feminist revolution and the Republican Party, Newt Gingrich versus Megyn Kelly, and many other showdowns that are happening. Second, the new Amazon show, Good Girls Revolt, about a civil rights lawsuit against a news magazine in the late 60s based on a true event. And finally, Chelsea Clinton and what we learn about her from the email leaks. And our Slate Plus topic, June, can you tell us about that?
Yes. In our Slate Plus segment, we'll discuss whether the UN is sexist. If you're not yet a Slate Plus member, you can start your free 2-week trial by visiting slate.com/xxplus.
Okay, so let's start with the feminist revolution. The current wave of feminist anger is coming from the Republican Party. On the post-Roger Ailes Fox News, there was a showdown between Megyn Kelly and Newt Gingrich, which started a lot of hand-wringing and op-eds and Twitter and social media of prominent Republican women who are furious at their party for failing to condemn Trump. So before we get going, let's just listen to a second from this clip for people who haven't heard it. It is a long showdown, and I really recommend we'll include a link on our show page. You go listen to it. But we'll just play a minute at the end, which has gotten a lot of play, where Newt Gingrich accuses Megyn Kelly of being... Ladies?
Fascinated with sex.
Fascinated with sex.
Fascinated
right.
with sex.
Fascinated.
And worst of all, uninterested in public policy, the greatest sin of all.
That is worth
When you want to go back through the tapes of your show recently, you are fascinated with sex and you don't care about public policy.
Me?
Now, that's
really?
What I get out of watching you tonight.
You know what, Mr. Speaker? I'm not fascinated by sex, but I am fascinated by the protection of women. And understanding what we're getting in the Oval Office. And I think the American voters would like
and
to
know. And therefore, we're going to send Bill Clinton back to the East Wing because, after all, you are worried about sexual predators.
Yeah, listen, it's not about me. It's about the women and men of America. And the poll numbers show us that the women of America in particular are very concerned about these allegations and in large part believe that they are a real issue. And
you want to
don't
comment,
dismiss
you want to comment
women
on whether the
Clinton...
I love that she says she's fascinated with the protection of women.
Yeah.
Aren't we all?
Well, the interesting thing is that he conceives of it as sex and not public policy, right? Like, it's not, it's just, this is just about sex. It's not a sex scandal, exactly, right? Like, she's framing it as a sexual harassment legal problem, not a sex scandal.
Right.
Like, it is public policy. You know,
and I mean, as everybody who's written about this has pointed out, this is the guy, Newt Gingrich, who almost single-handedly pushed for the impeachment of Bill Clinton because of sex issues that had nothing to do with public policy whatsoever.
And, right.
And in this case, it's not even sex. It's sexual assault. That's the issue. It's not who did Donald Trump have sex with.
Right. And it's not like who did Donald Trump have an affair with? Like, it's not a sex thing. It's like it's a harassment thing. It's a different category than sex. Possibly the opposite of sex. So what happened as a result of this? A lot of prominent Republican women who've worked for Ted Cruz, who've worked for Mitt Romney, came out and were disappointed with their party. What did you guys make of the nature of that disappointment, which seemed to be like it was expressed almost as a lapse in chivalry, is how it came out.
I mean, sometimes it was. I mean, I know exactly what you mean by that, Hannah, but it also felt like that there was a big last straw phenomenon that some women who are, you know, real hardline trenches, you know, Republican women, insiders, who are just like, listen, if you keep making boneheaded moves like this, there are not going to be any women left in the Republican Party. And I think it was a genuine exasperation on their part. It was both, you know, from certain parts of the party, you know, conservative, maybe Christian parts of the party, just exasperation with these men like, you know, Tony Perkins and Ralph Reed and that kind of, you know, sort of religious type leader who are always going on about morals when it comes to queer people, but now doesn't seem to have any moral compunction for a guy who's, you know, an accused sexual predator in double-digit occasions. And so I think it's just sort of, exasperation with the double standards, but also with the boneheaded sort of strategic moves. When you choose a guy like that and you have a problem with women in your party, you're just going to make the problem with women in your party 10 times worse.
I think it's also this recognition of a benevolent kind of sexism as actual sexism, that this idea that women should be treated differently, you know, and that they should be protected. Or Paul Ryan said after that Access Hollywood tape came out that women should be championed and revered. I mean, that's still sexism. That's still, you know, women aren't the same as men and shouldn't be treated the same as men. And I think now a lot of women in the Republican Party are realizing that, you know, accepting that kind of sexism is never going to result in the kind of treatment that they want.
Well, that's what I don't know if that's happening or not. That's what I was curious about. Like, I couldn't tell if the resistance to Trump was a kind of, oh, my eyes are wide open, you're not protecting and revering us. Because there was, you know, there is a strain of kind of Sarah Palin Western feminism, like women are special in a certain way. They have a special role in history. Men should be men. Women should be women. And is Trump a violation of that? Or is this a really like scales fall from the eyes moment where you realize that actually if you have the pedestal thing, you also get the sexism thing? Like you can't have one without the other. Like is it a true realization in that way?
I'm hoping and thinking that for at least for the younger women in the Republican Party that their minds are still malleable enough to have that sort of sea change shift in their conception of how men will treat them. But no, I think you're right. I mean, for a lot of people, it's Donald Trump is just one small step too far that some kinds of sexism are acceptable, but bragging about sexually assaulting women or protecting a man who does is not.
Yeah, I was wondering if sexual harassment is going to turn out to be the great unifier, you know, that it's just an issue that everyone's experienced, everyone can relate to, everyone's had some version of it in a workplace. So somehow it's like a boiling over moment. Like it becomes, you know, how did gay rights become a kind of mainstream thing that everyone stopped caring about it except the religious right? Like, is this one of those moments where everyone unifies because everyone can identify with the kind of Donald Trump moment in their life?
I don't know about that. I mean, I'm not, because it's so many things in so many groups. I don't know that we can, you know, pin it down to just one particular, this is what it's going to do. I think there's a combination of just the way he talks about women. There's the Rosie O'Donnell, you know, aspect. There's the sexual predator aspect. There's the just doesn't seem to get it aspects. And I think it's, you know, these combinations, as it always is, are what is just... There's nothing redeeming for this guy and women. I mean, he keeps saying the same things. He keeps saying how he hired women and how, you know, he loves his daughter who he thinks is super hot. But it's so obvious, you know, it's so impossible not to see the double standards and the contempt that's maybe underneath that pedestaling that has always been maybe allowing some people to see a different side of the way that sort of conservative men behave around women.
And when I watched that Access Hollywood recording, I mean, I saw so many men that I have encountered in my life in that recording, but to varying degrees. And so I wonder if some people have watched that and seen or recognized maybe somebody in their lives or somebody, other men in the Republican Party who mirror that sort of attitude toward women without being quite so crude about it.
Yeah, and it's a political problem, right? I mean, so when Newt Gingrich is up there, you know, arguing with Megyn Kelly about how she's fascinated with sex, he's saying that this thing, which is a really in-your-face problem for a lot of women every day, just doesn't matter. And whatever he means by public policy, I don't know, tax rates, is so much more salient to them and their lives. And it's just really, really hard for most women to go, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's just it's not good politics apart from everything else. It's not an attractive line of argumentation.
It's like so attractive to believe that, like, when you really want to believe that Megyn Kelly represents something. It's not like she's a perfect, like she's got, right, you know, she's got crazy in her background, but
lots of
lots of it, and politically speaking, crazy. But you just want to believe that, like, she's the vanguard of some revolution. You know, aren't you guys tempted? Like when you see her, you're like, they will follow. She will hold. the torch and they will follow.
I don't know. I'm scared of that just because of her, what she's done in the past. I mean, she's sold out, like with the Duggar family. She chose to be kind to them. It feels like her moments of quote unquote feminist outrage are strategically chosen and might not stem from a genuine place of belief.
Do you think that? Do you think they're erratic or strategic? Like, do you think it's just like mood? Like one day she just is sick of Newt Gingrich and sick of Donald Trump, or it's actually like it's a pose?
I think she's smart and she knows that there are certain moments like when Newt Gingrich is being ridiculous and is just sort of this archetype of this old, out-of-touch man who is willing to throw women under the bus for whatever minuscule political gain he can grasp. I think she realizes that, you know, that's the moment to galvanize women in a feeling of like, we're not going to take it anymore.
Right, right. Yeah. So here's the other thing. Strategically, this is about a gender gap, right? Like one thing. So women are offended, but also there's like Republican strategist women saying, you know, the elections are won or lost by women. Republicans have always relied on white married women, particularly, and we are losing them, and that's just idiotic because we can't win an election without them. So that's the, you know, that's the like numbers game that they're worried about. The thing that was most interesting to me about the numbers game is, so they're predicting this gigantic gender gap, right? It's mm-hmm. like some polls have it at 26 points. The next largest gender gap where more women voted for Democrats than Republicans was Bill Clinton. Post-scandal, right? Like the scandals came out during the election. So how do we explain that? Like, oh, that was the 90s and we didn't take sexual harassment that seriously? Or do we explain that as like people look at Trump and see what you said, June, disdain for women? And even though the facts are similar in some of these cases, people look at Clinton and do not see disdain for women for whatever reason.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is something about people. And I mean, I never know quite the extent to which people vote for policies or for the candidate that they just think is a better person or someone they can relate more to. And Bill Clinton was always very relatable. I mean, I have so many problems with Bill Clinton's behavior, but I actually wasn't able to vote back then, but I would have voted for him even despite all that, because he and some of his policies that he put through in his time in office were absolutely terrible, very, very harmful to LGBTQ people, for example. But he doesn't ever seem to – he doesn't come across as a guy who is contemptuous of men, even though we know from things that he's done that, you know, he sometimes behaves that way. And Donald Trump just can't speak about women without sounding awful. And, you know, I realize, yes, that I have a partisan bias there. But I think the message of this segment is that even partisan Republican women can't see past Donald Trump's, you know, attitude to women, that it's just too obvious. His problems are too in your face, whereas Bill's, there's still enough sort of doubt to go, well, is he really so bad? And it, with Trump, it's just obvious. Yeah, he really is so bad.
I think if Bill Clinton had had Twitter, I think if there had been more hot mics in that era, I think if people had been recording him when he didn't think he was being recorded, we might have similar situations. Yeah. I think a lot of politicians, journalists are probably thinking, watching that Access Hollywood recording, that like, oh, thank God I wasn't wearing a mic at X occasion. Mm-hmm. Or like, oh, yeah, heard that, said that. I don't think Donald Trump is necessarily unique in that regard, that he speaks about women that way. I imagine that. I mean, I know he said, actually, like Bill Clinton has said worse stuff to me on the golf course, which I don't really give a crap about. But I also think that's probably true.
Oh, my God. That would have been so. Can you imagine if Paula Jones had recorded, like if we had Kiss It recorded on the cell phone? Just like, how much would that have been played during that era? But you're so right.
Yeah
you're totally. So right. If we had heard his drawl, like his, you know, his drawl just making a play, like we would
right
not
now
get that out of our head. Kiss It. So, okay, so just to close this off, what do we think this is going to result in? Like, what is the what is the long-term consequence of this revolt among Republican women? Like, does it go anywhere? Does it lead to anything policy-wise? Does it change the party in any way? Does it sober them up? Like, what does it actually mean?
I mean, I look forward after the after every election, there are these postmortems, and it seems like for the last, well, as many elections as I can remember, the Republicans have been like, oh, my God, we're a shrinking party. Our demographic is shrinking. And, guess what? It's shrinking still more this time. So you would think that they would have already been addressing this. And then, Luke, they go and, find a nominee who embodies their biggest problems. So I don't know what it portends. I mean, there's so much messed up this election. If you listen to the TrumpCast podcast, it seems like every episode there's a discussion of how, the Trump candidacy could portend the division of the Republican Party or complete sea change in the Republican Party, or it could just be business as usual.
But what about certain feminist issues, like not just for the party, but for like that you suddenly realize that, sexual harassment is something. It's not a culture war issue. It's not something like foisted on by the PC left on the rest of the country. Like, it's actually something that everybody gives a shit about. Like, maybe that's, maybe that's what changes, that those issues get, taken out of the box of like sort of feminist left and put in the box of like everybody, just mainstream universal.
I think the Fox News sexual harassment stuff has probably had as much of an effect to think like these women who think like me, who I watch, who I, at least try to relate to, are saying that this is a real thing or are recognizing that this is an actual problem. I think that would have an effect on women probably more than men. I don't think Republican men are going to change anytime soon. On the other hand, people have really short memories, so it's going to be hard to forget Donald Trump, all the things that he's said and done, and forget that, I'm sure the Democratic Party won't let us forget who defended him. Will people care? I mean, I don't know. I think that one candidate's not really enough to change this sort of ideological opposition to feminism.
Yeah. And, there's two letters that you said, Hannah, PC. There is this view that certain issues are just PC policing. And, a whole lot of Donald Trump's support, which let's remember is millions and millions and millions of Americans, seems to be driven by the fact that he challenges PC. So I'm not so optimistic that everything's just going to turn out fine and all our attitudes will change. I think there might actually be an entrenchment and a sort of polarization, which is really depressing.
Okay, so I'm the optimist on the podcast. When does that ever happen?
You think it's going to change?
I don't know. I feel that the way that this issue kind of surfaced and the way women not unified in any public way, like there wasn't a march, but the way women all over everywhere were just like, for the most of the year, it was like all the news was coming from college campuses. And despite what the New York Times thinks, like not everybody can relate to women on college campuses. That's a small minority of the American population. But like suddenly it's like college campuses, Fox News, some journal, like it just seems like it's coming from everywhere. So it feels like more of a truth. I'm not sure what it leads to.
Right.
But there is like a unified nod on the part of American women everywhere. Okay, our second topic, Good Girls Revolt. This is a new Amazon Prime show about a news magazine in the late 60s. It's loosely based on an incident at Newsweek where 40-some women sued the magazine for discrimination. The show takes off in time where Mad Men left off. It's a workplace where women are working, but they're working in service to men. They are the researchers, and the men get all the glory and the bylines. There's lots of workplace drama, sex, a small cameo by a Nora Ephron character. June, you've read the book, right?
Yes,
the Lynn Povich
yes.
book on which this is based.
Yes.
So it's a promising topic. We'll start there. Like, it's an interesting incident. Like, what? Why did you read the book? Like, what struck you as interesting about this, this particular moment or this particular lawsuit?
Well, I have to confess that I read the book because at the time I was doing a podcast in which I interviewed the authors of new nonfiction books, and I did interview Lynn Povich for that show afterward, which you can find in iTunes. And it did strike me as an interesting moment, you know, that partly as a journalist, because they're especially in that kind of old school journalism where, you know, there's that mantra of you shouldn't be the story, you should cover the story. It was an interesting example of a certain kind of mostly privileged women who were used to kind of, you know, covering big news events, who suddenly found themselves as the story. And a lot of the discussion in the book was, you know, maybe we'll lose our jobs, which we like and which we know how lucky we are to have. And also just that, but we can't go on like this. You know, it was an inflection point of we can't just keep doing this. Somebody's got to stand up. And so we'll be the ones to do it. So it was a very interesting story. And it, you know, there's one of several lawsuits in the journalism business that changed the way that women, the kind of jobs that women were, you know, were available to women. And also was kind of a sexy time, you know, even in the book, which came out in the era of Mad Men. I think it came out in 2012. You know, there's a lot of talk about all of the affairs that happened, you know, in the workplace and so on. So, you know, yeah, there was a lot of potential for a sexy series.
There was
a lot of potential for a sexy series. So what happened to the sexy series? What did you think? Just tell me, like, your first reaction. We by the way, listeners, we will try not to spoil too much, but this is one of the problems in this situation. It's like, it's a historical moment. So, like, there is a lawsuit. And it's one of the problems with the narrative tension in this series is that you kind of, like, know where it's going. So we won't spoil particular details of, like, big plot reveals or anything like that. But we are going to talk generally about the show.
Yeah.
I was sort of audibly sighing in exasperation at this show. It seems like, you know, any sort of typical blatant element of sexism you might find in the workplace all happened in the first two episodes. It was a lot of like, well, now listen, sweetheart, you gotta stay in your place and like don't make waves around here, and that's not how women behave.
That was me. He did write a court story. I rewrote it.
What? Girls do not do rewrites.
Why not?
That's simply how we do things here. We have rules, protocol.
Those rules are dumb. If copy's good, it's good.
Young lady, you might not want to make waves, lest we have doubts about our decision to hire you.
But you just said my rewrite hit the bullseye. That was your word, bullseye.
Why is everyone standing around here like a bunch of carnies? Huh? Back to work. You too, dear.
And it felt very like really shoved into a very short period of time. And I'm kind of, it's like a, well, you know, the journalism piece of advice, show, don't tell. It felt like there's a lot of telling and that the sexism in the show is just so explicit, and it's not the sort of like slow grinding institutional soul crushing sexism that actually did lead to this change in how women were treated in journalism. It was like every sort of character that you might expect would be in a show taking place in 1970, like the one who thinks she wants to get married and not be a career girl, the one who has like this sexual awakening and discovers masturbation for the first time. It's all there.
Yeah. I mean, that it really like there were I was so wishing it would be more impressionistic. Like, the thing I love the most about it almost is the architecture of the office. Like, the scenes that kind of stay with me dreamily are the scenes where, say, like, the boss is like, let's call a meeting. And the women are kind of left down in the pit, which is literally called the pit. And you see the men kind of rushing to the office. Like, there's just something about that which is, like, you can't believe it, you know? Like, you can't believe the way. It's like the waves of movement are so interesting in the show, like just the way it's arranged and just kind of the assumptions of that world, you know, that in service to men assumptions of that world. I wish they had just like spent one first episode just kind of landing that, you know, like here is a world in which there are just like, if you assume that the women in the workplace are in service to the men, what are all the little things that change as a result of that, that you never would have thought of, never would have realized about where the bathroom is, about, you know, how the architecture of the office looks like what, how the men talk to each other. So there are little moments like that, which I think are the best parts of the show. But then it's almost like in my imagination, it's like the people are moving around, then someone puts their foot out and like trips the show, you know, with some with some like, don't put me in a box or, you know, whatever, like one of the things that you mentioned, which are just like so on the nose that they kind of strangle the characters, you know.
I know from our previous conversations that I liked the show a little bit more than you, but I just want to just stipulate, it's not a good show. Like, it has some really big flaws that are, they're just kind of baked into it. Like, it's just, as you say, Hannah and Christina, it will always take the most obvious, you always make the most obvious choice. There's very little subtlety. There's very little nuance. They didn't really trust the audience at all to make connections for themselves. At the same time, as somebody who spends quite a lot of time watching mediocre television, and I'm actually quite happy when I find watchable mediocre television that isn't, you know, appallingly violent or sexist or, you know, that is just basically watchable and decent. I did find the story interesting. There were, like I said, it not only because I knew what was going to what happened in real life and I'd read the book, but just because everything is telegraphed. They're absolutely incapable of ever springing surprises. But but the three main actresses are really good, I thought. They are Anna Camp, who is fantastic as this sort of, you know, as Anna, I think.
Anna Camp character.
Yeah, right. Her character is Jane, who is just like this very fancy, you know, Bryn Mawr girl with super rich parents who just want her to get her, what is that? They just wanted to get her MRS. And they are really invested in her finding the right kind of husband.
Genevieve, and her weight.
Oh, my God. And going on about her weight. And she couldn't be any skinnier without blowing away. Genevieve Angelson is Patty, who's probably the main character, kind of countercultural. She's, I guess, a hippie chick, but also she's hip to the way that the kids are changing things.
And they literally say that. They're like, hey, you're a kid and you're hip to the way kids are changing. Why don't you tell me about it, kid?
Of course they do.
And Erin, she gets her boss interested in pot.
Yes, of course she does. And Erin Dark, who plays this woman, Cindy, who's the one in the terrible marriage, who learns to masturbate.
Now, I do love her. Whenever she comes on the screen, I feel very happy. I love her. I think she's like a particular character. Like, the moves they put her through, the consciousness raising, are, you know, just blindingly obvious. But like, just as a like a just kind of like a delight. I love going into the little caption office with her and the photographer. I just like those. That's when I'm happy, when the show does that.
Interesting.
So this is a thing I wanted to bring up. Mm-hmm. Her relationship with with the photo editor or whatever. It seems like they try to pass off this kind of disturbing incident of workplace sexual harassment as this important and wonderful moment in her sexual awakening. That bothered me.
Yeah, it was weird because, yes, she realized. So, yeah, she's essentially taken advantage of, if it would be a way of summarizing it very briefly. And it does seem that she realizes that she's been taken advantage of and also kind of is positively affected by it, too.
I read that totally differently. That is so interesting. This may say more about me than it does about the show. I read that moment as, like, first of all, it was the only thing that surprised me in the entire several first episodes. I did not see that that's where he was going. Like, I just didn't. Mm-hmm. I thought something more, like, usual was going to happen, yeah. You know? And so I did not see, and I saw that as a moment of, it's totally, oh my God, what's wrong with me? As him prostrating himself. In a way, like to what she, like what we are supposed to understand from that moment is that her husband would never understand. It's like he was pushing her one step forward in the thing that she was trying to figure out. And thus that was a moment about him actually listening to her as opposed to what her husband always did, which was not hear or listen to a word she said. So like he knew where her heart and mind were going and wanted to go. But it is also an incident of harassment.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It gets, I think, in later episodes, it gets a little bit, he becomes less endearing in that regard, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. One thing that I wanted to talk about is the weird way that the show, so it's based on a real situation that happened at Newsweek, but this is the events of Good Girls Revolt, the TV show, take place in a sort of parallel universe where it's News of the Week, and there is another institution called Newsweek. But some of the two, I think just two characters who are in the real story, Nora Ephron and Eleanor Holmes Norton, also do their real life roles in this fictional universe. And that felt to me like a very big mistake and kind of exploitative because they were exploiting like the fact that people know who Nora Ephron was. And it is also responsible for one of the worst lines of dialogue, which all the reviews quote, where as she is making a big stand, somebody says to her, "Your name is all you have in journalism, so good luck, Nora Ephron." You think, oh, my God. Thanks for that subtlety.
I think that was the moment in maybe the first episode where I realized exactly what this show was trying to do.
Exactly. And I think that's right. But then the use of Eleanor Holmes Norton, who in real life was indeed the woman who made the lawsuit, you know, prosecuted the lawsuit. She was at the ACLU. She was pregnant as in the real case. But she's not in this fictional story. And also, the black women in the office who in the TV show come in on the lawsuit. One of the things they're doing all through the series is reaching out to other women in the office to persuade them to come in on the lawsuit, which is, you know, slightly risky or actually I wouldn't say slight, which is risky. And in the TV show, the black women join in. But in real life, the black women didn't. I just had a little look at the book this morning, and I think Lynn Povich says, you know, the black women were more, the black civil rights movement was more salient to them than, you know, women's rights. Like that sort of weird combination of real life and fictional life felt very uncomfortable to me, and I wish they hadn't done that. It seemed like it sort of muddied things up.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of loved, I agree with you, June. I think it was too dissonant, it added to the dissonance of the show for me. But, you know, Eleanor Holmes Norton is my congressional representative, my non-voting delegate to Congress as a D.C. resident. She's Hannah's also. And I mean, just in sort of a documentary sort of way, I love learning more about her. I didn't know she was the person who prosecuted the lawsuit. I didn't know she was pregnant at the time. She's so damn woke in the show, and right, so is her husband. Right. And I think that the actress who plays her is one of the best in the show.
Yeah, Joy Bryant. Joy Bryant, who I believe is going to be a guest on Aisha Harris's podcast Represent this week.
Oh, excellent.
Very cool.
So what did you guys think of the portrayal of the men in the show? Like, they weren't, you know, completely boorish in terms of stereotypes. There were boorish moments, which seemed appropriate. They were, like, exceedingly dumb. Like, they didn't seem to know how to make, like, a single reporting phone call or figure out anything for themselves. Now, I don't know if Lynn Povich's book, I mean, it did, like in, you know, again, a kind of non-subtlety of the show, the women seem to make all the reporter breaks.
Right.
Right? Like, exactly. They seem to break through every single moment of every story.
Yes.
Now, it couldn't have, it wasn't like, they weren't, like, sitting up with their feet up on the table and the women were just, like, reporting all the stories. I mean, that's not how it was it?
No. I mean, it can't possibly have been. I mean, even in the most, even if Donald Trump and Bill Clinton's worst excesses ruled the world, it couldn't have been that, you know, that polarized. It's too cartoonish of a characterization, but it's just part of that no surprises thing. Of course, the woman is always going to have the bright idea. At the same time, I kind of liked the view, or I liked the representation of journalism. You know how when you know a little bit about a world, it tends to put you off things. I mean, The Wire, the greatest show on television in television history, I think every journalist feels like the final season about journalism is the least successful. And even though maybe it's because it wasn't like the show isn't really based in real life particularly, I didn't mind the presentation of journalism. It made it seem interesting and you know, world-changing and, you know, like the greatest job in the world.
I definitely got that sort of, it felt like a journalism porn to me in some ways in the manner of Spotlight. It also made me really stressed out about my work. It was always like, deadline, deadline, deadline. And I'm like, oh, crap, I've got a deadline, you know. It was like too real in some ways.
Yeah, it wasn't wildly far off. Like, I didn't, you know, some shows you watch about journalism are just completely ridiculous. I mean, it was compressed, but like in terms of how you would figure out a story about the Black Panthers or sort of how you would go about kind of making it, it wasn't like ridiculously far off, I don't think.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so June, since you're the biggest defender, like if you are one of our listeners, and what is the reason to watch this show?
There is very good acting from the three lead actresses and a couple of other people along the way. It is in an exaggerated sort of positive story about the awakening of, you know, feminist consciousness. It's an obvious but sort of interesting time in American history, or fascinating and crazy time in American history. So even this very peculiar sanitized version of it is interesting. If you don't like to be surprised, it's perfect for you.
I'm imagining like the big New York Times spread, which is like, watchably mediocre, says June Thomas. If you don't like surprises, this is the show for you.
Well, that's exactly what it is, though. It's like NCIS. It's like, you know what it totally reminds me of is Madam Secretary. I don't know if you've ever watched that. CBS Sundays. It's not a good show. It's about the Secretary of State. Tay Leone is the Secretary of State. And when it first was announced, everyone was like, oh, my God, that's much too close to Hillary Clinton's story. That, like, it's going to be like Clinton propaganda. And it's totally not, because it's just not a particularly good show. But it's totally watchable because it's just like people being brave and people making the right call and people being in danger but surviving. It's like it's good. It's good. I'm not going to say it's good
drama.
Television or good drama, because it's not, but it's super watchable when you don't want to be tested.
Well, like, yeah. I think Verilyn said, you can do something else while you're watching this show. And it's nice to, you know, be plunged into that time in history and to listen to Inagata DeVita and watch people tripping on acid and peeling their clothes off. And there are a lot of very attractive people in the show.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's something to put on in the background and, you know, have a rah-rah moment of second wave feminism.
Yeah, I've been hesitating to whether I should make this point, and I may cut it out. But one, I'm realizing me and Joan can totally watch TV together, because I like that Secretary of State show as well. But also the moment when they're trying to convince Denise, which is one of the Black researchers in the newsroom, to join, is before they actually get Eleanor in to convince her to join the suit. And she's like, you know, this is not my fight, essentially. And then she says, well, you all did this piece. And like, what's her name?
Patty.
Patty's like, you know, like, why, you know, what do you mean? And she's like, well, you all just did the story on the Black Panthers. Was any Black person involved in it?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that was one moment where I was like, I know there are a lot of people that were with Patty until that moment, and hopefully it did change minds. I think like they were very on the nose, like 99.9% of the time. But I think like moments like that where they said something, and because maybe, you know, I think, Christina, you said about being woke, right? I think Eleanor's main driving is to be like the very woke black feminist person on the show. Besides her, there wasn't many moments for that. And I think that moment with Denise was the one other moment it happened.
Yeah. It's the Helena Holmes Norton role is really weird because she definitely is that role, that, you know, woke feminist together woman whose consciousness is already raised and who is doing it for these other women. At the same time, it's a total magical role because she's like the only married woman. Like, she's got a great husband. She's got a, yeah. He loves her. They dance together. It's like, that's not a real person. Or it's not, it's so different from all the other people that it's ironic.
Well, it's the magical Negro trope, right? Well, it's the you know, she's, in order for her to be a woman that helps, makes this happen, she has to be perfect in all these other ways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little too textbook.
Yeah, I mean, the Efron was like a magical Efron character,
right,
too.
Right,
you know, where she just breezes in and says all the wise things, and then it's like, you losers, you go fight over the bottom bunk, I'm
in jail,
out, you know, and she's like, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, there was a little bit of that, like, magicalness, the famous magical people breezing in and out.
Right.
All right, watchably mediocre, no surprises, and watch it while you're doing other things. That is our...
It's a rousing endorsement.
All right, our final topic, Chelsea. From the latest batch of leaked Clinton emails, I don't know if it's a new picture of Chelsea emergence, but you get little... You sort of add to the picture of Chelsea, since we have so little to go with. Mm-hmm. She's decidedly grown up. She's worried about the ethics of the Clinton Foundation. And she is definitely a Clinton. Christina, I want to ask you, before we jump into exactly what we learned from the emails, like, what did you grow up with as an impression of Chelsea? Like, was she someone you felt bad for? Like, oh, the little girl who got, you know, who got kind of abused by the press? Or was she, like, was she neutral to you? Like, did you have any sort of emotional impression of her?
No. I mean, I was trying to think about this as I was, you know, reading up for this recording session. And I don't think I was aware enough of, you know, the press narrative to really feel much about Chelsea. I was, you know, pretty young at the time of the first Clinton presidency. And I think, you know, she was relatively close in age to me. It was the first presidency that I was ever alive and aware for. So I just kind of felt like there's a kid in the White House. And it wasn't until I got older that I was sort of surprised to learn that she was, you know, made fun of in the press and that she was sort of the focus of all this right-wing angst.
So you just feel neutral, basically. It's like you take her as she is.
Yeah. And these emails gave me a really positive impression of her as sort of this moral compass for her family, embarrassed by people using her family name to further their own interests. And, you know, there's definitely whatever sense I've developed of her as an adult has sort of been like, oh, you know, she's probably just this kind of spoiled kid who grew up in wealth and power, and I wouldn't expect much of her in the vein of a moral compass. But yeah, I was sort of impressed by how she interacted in these emails.
It was really striking, wasn't it, how she comes across as like a normal person. I mean, this is a woman who grew up in the White House or in the governor's mansion in Arkansas, and who has had so just kind of the opposite of a normal life and is in many ways the ultimate insider. She probably knows more about, you know, politics and politicians just in the sort of casual way of gossip or just people who come to dinner than anyone in the world. And yet her response was that of a normal person. Like, she was saying things like, this is wrong. She was seeing multi-million dollar speaking fees or contributions being solicited. And instead of sort of having an insider response of, you know, oh, we're the kind of where the streams set kept separate, where, you know, where all the rules followed, her response was more of that of a normal person saying, this is surely not kosher. And that surprised me, but also impressed me in a sort of in a way.
I read this whole thing differently. I felt like it was, you know, okay, so here's a sentence that she wrote that explains what we're talking about. She writes, "My only objective was to take stock, professionalize the foundation, build it for the future, and build it in such a way that supported his work and my mom's." Now, what this refers to is Doug Band, who was a right-hand man of Bill Clinton. There were sort of some dealings that made her uncomfortable. Like, he had a private company, and they were calling and using Bill's name. And then he wrote back that she was a spoiled brat, and she just doesn't understand how the money is made and how her, you know, how her lifestyle supported. He wrote, "I just don't think any of this is right. We should be treated this way. When no one else is, only because CVC, that's Chelsea Victoria Clinton, has nothing better to do and needs to justify her existence." So this is like a back and forth between the kind of thuggish surrogate son of Bill Clinton and the actual daughter of Bill Clinton. Now, why did I read it differently? Because, like, I just see the whole picture of Chelsea, and I see someone operating in like a teeny tiny little space, you know? Like, what counts as rebellion for her is like working in a New York consulting firm making money.
Right.
Like, that's how she broke away from her family and married this hedge fund guy, you know, who also made millions of dollars because he's married to her. Like, and then what counts as whistleblowing for her is like protecting the name of the foundation of her father and actually going to work there so that she could run the foundation, so that now she can finally come out and say that she's not ruling out running for office one day. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
so
yeah.
it felt like operating in just this like teeny tiny, like, all she's trying to do is like keep a thug from dirtying the business so that she can, you know, she can be clean, basically, so the family can. It felt like Hillary Clinton without, like, at least Hillary Clinton started out as kind of a radical, like with a voice who was passionate. This seemed like you were born into this world and you were just trying to like protect this little world, and like you never got to breathe. I don't know. It didn't do much.
I totally get where you're coming from, Hannah, and I can't argue with that perspective, because I think fundamentally it's almost certainly true. But Chelsea Clinton and Hillary Clinton had very different backgrounds. And Chelsea Clinton is Chelsea Clinton. Like, yeah, it is ridiculous that your form of rebellion is going to work for McKinsey. Yeah, that's ridiculous. But when your dad was president and your mom is, you know, now Secretary of State, or what, I guess she, when Chelsea did that, Hillary hadn't yet been Secretary of State, but she was like running for the Senate. Like, when her mother, when both your parents are just the highest possible level of politicians, you're so restricted that in that crazy world, working for McKinsey is rebellion. And yeah, you can see it as her, you know, keeping clean so that she can have, you know, run for office one day. But it also is just, this is a person who, you know, was obviously struggling to find herself, but also had all the money and all the privilege in the world, and so could get 3 graduate degrees from places like Oxford and Columbia. And, you know, clearly she didn't have to do any of those things. You know, she could have just been a complete dilettante, you know, but she did get all those degrees, and she clearly does have a genuine interest in policy. And so that, yes, even though it did serve to keep her name clean, I think she probably genuinely did want to not have the foundation that bears her name, as well as her parents' name, descend into a pit of utter disreputability. So, you know, like, it's both.
Yeah,
I think maybe my expectations for ethical behavior for somebody of her upbringing are so low that it probably didn't take much to impress me here. But, you know, if I could make an imperfect comparison, think about what the emails of, oh, I don't know, Donald Trump Jr. would look like. I don't think he would be concerned with, you know, dubious business dealings or you know, using his family name for nefarious ends.
Yeah.
I also sort of got the sense that, you know, this might not be right, but she was sort of busting up this old boys club in a way, that this guy thought he should get special treatment. He's calling her a spoiled brat who doesn't know what she wants in life. That really rubbed me the wrong way, and it made me more sympathetic to her. I also loved that she used this phrase of her grandmother's.
Right.
There's 3 sides to every story: his, hers, and the truth, which is like such a weird old phrase that I kind of love that she brought that into her emails with the foundation.
I'm with you that the Doug Band response seemed sexist, like, you bratty little girl. I mean, she's got several degrees. She worked at McKinsey. Like, she has plenty of life and work experience to be able to come in and do an audit on her own parents' foundation. Like, that definitely made me bristle. Like, who are you and what are you trying to protect? You know, your lying employees who call up and say, I'm calling in the name of Bill Clinton when he hasn't authorized it. Like, that was irritating. Mm-hmm. But then there's, like, her book, It's Your World, Get Informed. Get inspired and get going. It's just like, oh, God. It's like, revolt, good girl. Just revolt a little bit,
Exactly. Well, and just, again, these emails that we're reading because they've been nefariously revealed, but they were sort of sympathy building because they were so honestly kind of pathetic. I mean, the language of, you know, the, like, it's not just that they were using, what's that test that people take here? You know, fancy words that, you know, to get into college, what's the test?
SAT.
Yeah. SAT.
You know, these emails full of, like, SAT words, like these full of these very earnest kind of, you know, sentiments to her mother. And, you know, she and her mom both having these really earnest conversations about right on things. You know, those are not particularly relationships that, like, it's funny because I've always wanted to have, like, an intellectual relationship with a parent, and that, you know, I never had that. And then I think, well, if that's it, I don't want that one. And also the fact that
what do you mean? Can you refer in case, because I didn't know this before I prepped for this, so people may not know what you're referring to. Oh, I have them. Okay, I think I wrote some of them down. So she writes to her mom. Such anathema to us as Americans and a painful reminder of how long it took modernism to take root in the U.S. after the Enlightenment, the 14th, 15th, 16th, 19th Amendments. Much to discuss when we talk, hopefully tomorrow. Now, June, I'm sure you, like me, this is a typical topic of conversation in your household.
Totes.
All the different amendments.
After us and our moms finish watching Judge Judy, then we talk about how modernism took root.
Exactly. Like, in some ways, I find that, like I say, I crave it. And then I think, oh, yeah, no, maybe not. And the fact that she sometimes signed her emails under aliases that were Diane Reynolds and Anna James. And again, it's like this sort of sympathy building picture of somebody who isn't exactly comfortable with herself and is trying to be someone else. At the same time, sometimes, let's not forget, does take advantage of her position, you know, as probably people would. Like, you know, that terrible job at NBC News, which seems to have been an awful, awful abuse of, you know, fame. But as she is a Clinton, you know, there's an amendment. I don't know which one it is. I'm not able to quote them like she could. That at one point, she must become president.
Right. Well, maybe this is what she is. She's like an earnest, serious, public policy minded person who believes in accountability. And, you know, if the NBC job showed us anything, it's like that lady is not a journalist. You know, she did, like, earnest, do-gooding, sort of straightforward reports on things. And, like, that's fine. Like, that's not a bad thing to be in the world. You know, that's okay.
Yeah.
It's all right.
It's also kind of what I want in a president.
Yeah. Like, the emails weren't like anything that you wouldn't want in a president. Like, they weren't embarrassing. They were serious. They weren't bratty. They didn't ask for special favors. Mm-hmm. You know, they were like good.
Right.
They were the emails of a good, concerned citizen with a big vocabulary. Well, that's our show, except for Slate Plus. But before we go there, let's do our recommendations. June, why don't you start us off?
All right. I want to recommend a piece that was in Deadspin last week about it was by Dave McKenna, and it was called The Writer Who Was Too Strong to Live. It was a profile of a writer who I must confess I was never aware of. I don't believe I ever read any of her stories. And nevertheless, I was really fascinated by McKenna's portrait of a woman who was apparently an amazing sports writer, a brilliant journalist, a brilliant writer and mind and kind of the life of the party, and also an alcoholic who pretty much went from a most amazingly sort of stratospheric career where she, you know, went from newspapers around the country, was recruited by the New York Times, was then recruited by the Washington Post, which at the time had maybe the best sports writing team in journalism, and who then essentially drank herself out of her profession and then drank herself to death. And it was both sobering and also just really made me wish that I had known her and I had been familiar with her work, and was just really great writing.
Whew, I know a lot about that. And I read that whole thing from top to bottom. She and I actually sat next to each other in at the Washington Post in her late days at the style section when she was done doing sports writing. But she's very much a figure in my world, like my generation of journalists. And I worked at the Washington Post. And that was amazing to read, the close tracking of it. She also has a daughter who she's a single mother of. So so that was sort of some of the saddest moment of it, is the kind of Facebook posts basically trying to raise money for her daughter to go to college among our friends. But it is a great profile. So I want to recommend two things. I'm interviewing Carly Simon this week. Yes, the singer Carly Simon, about her book, Boys in the Trees. And I have to say, it's an excellent memoir, entirely written by her, not ghostwritten. Her father was the founder of Simon & Schuster. There are so many good stories in this book about Simon & Schuster, about her affairs, about her marriage to James Taylor, about Mick Jagger, about, you know, who it is that's so vain, about kind of growing up in that sort of upper crust Westchester-y sort of good girls revolt kind of life that she started. I mean, this book spans the exact era of good girls revolt. Like they start out as the kind of good girls destined for the MRS degree, and they end up sort of deep in the kind of 60s folk world. It's a truly, truly great book. I really like it. So anyway, there's that. And then Atlanta. God, do I love Atlanta. The show I'm talking about. I really, really love the Donald Glover show, Atlanta. Okay, Christina, what do you got?
I have been reading a book of stories by Alexandra Kleeman called Intimations. I have sort of developed a love affair with a short story this year, and this is one of the best volumes that I've read. The stories are just weird. I was not expecting it when I went in, but the point of view of the narrator is often almost like observing animals in a zoo or on a nature documentary, but she's talking about human behavior. Just these sort of grotesque descriptions of eating a dinner or, you know, having a date with a romantic partner, and these bewildered descriptions of, you know, how strange human beings are. It's really imaginative, and I cannot recommend it highly enough.
That sounds great. I don't know that book. Mm-hmm. What's her name, did you say?
Alexandra Kleeman.
Sounds great. All right. Well, that is our show for today. Thanks to our producer, Verilyn Williams. Executive producer of Slate Podcast, Steve Lickteig. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. And our wonderful intern is Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts, which are growing by leaps and bounds every day, at itunes.com/panoply. Show page to get our recommendations, find out more about the show and the things we talked about, slate.com/XX. As always, our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, to talk amongst yourselves, criticize us, recommend topics for the next show, or you can email us at XXGabFest@slate.com, subscribe on iTunes or any place where you get your podcasts, leave comments so more people can find out about the show. And for Christina and June, I am Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.